Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. And Stone, here we are broadcasting live from the Sandy Springs Innovation Center. What is it, week two?
It is week two, but I think it's our first full-blown production of Atlanta Business Radio from the new digs, right?
Yep.
So we're still getting it figured out. We're getting the lighting figured out and the seating, but this is going to be a fantastic show today. First up on Atlanta Business Radio, please join me in welcoming to the broadcast co-founder and CEO with Saltbox, Mr. Tyler Scriven. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, Tyler, before we get too far into things, tell us about Saltbox. How are you serving folks?
Sure. So Saltbox is a purpose-built workspace that's designed to enable e-commerce merchants, or really any company that sells physical goods. So you come to Saltbox, you're going to find office space, micro warehousing space, logistics services, likely in the future, working capital services and such. And so essentially trying to reduce the friction of operating an e-commerce company.
Well, we've been meeting a lot of folks in the co-working space, and we're finding that what once was an industry that was just kind of generalization of just anybody can come in and work out of the space, they're becoming nichier and nichier. Is that what compelled you to kind of focus in on the warehousing logistics side of the world for Saltbox?
Several years ago, bought an e-commerce company myself. Most of my career had been in the kind of high-tech world out in Silicon Valley, but I moved here, ended up acquiring an e-commerce business, and just saw how difficult it was to operate that company efficiently and all the challenges, and decided to start Saltbox in order to solve those.
And then, so initially, this was a solution for yourself?
Well, it wasn't. The idea came from, seeking a solution for myself. It's a venture-backed company that we started with, in a pretty intentional way last year. So, in fact, actually, that company has not yet moved the Saltbox, but they will very soon.
So now, walk me through the ideal person that's a Saltbox, what do you call, member, tenant?
We call them members, and we call them members in part because there's really vibrant community around the space. Who is that? Who is that common member? At their core, I would describe them as any company entrepreneur that is selling physical goods, whether that's, over the internet, as a traditional e-commerce retailer, perhaps a small scale distributor. Oftentimes you'll find them presently working in a self storage facility, in a basement, in a, warehouse is going to be torn down very soon.
Right.
And at Saltbox, they're finding, this highly resourceful community and space that is very intentionally built to enable their business.
Now, recently we had a guest on that started an e-commerce company kind of in their basement, the way you described, yep. And it's slowly getting traction. I think they did over $1 million last year. And then they built their own. They had to do everything kind of on their own, a one-off for just to solve their specific mm-hmm. challenge. Would that have been a good member for you in the early, as this thing was growing, would that have been a better fit? They would have been able to maybe scale faster and maybe have less headaches.
Absolutely. And it sounds like maybe even still would they be a great member. I think specifically what they would find at Saltbox would be, again, this combination of traditional co-working space combined with micro warehousing suites. So these are private spaces that range in size from a few hundred square feet to a few thousand. But outside of those four walls, you have kind of the full resources of a traditional warehouse facility, loading docks and pallet jacks, labor, integrated mail service, fulfillment services, so on and so forth.
Now, so if somebody's interested in becoming a member, what is the process? Like, do you have to vet them, or is anybody just say, hey, I want to be a member of Saltbox, then you get in?
Well, that's a good question. So, for better or worse, we only have, I think, one or two more spaces left here in our first location in Atlanta. We are building a few more. That being said, yeah, just come on a tour. We'd love to show folks the space. There's no application process. I mean, it's not a club. It's a product offering that you can buy. I will say that, you know, we find, we see lots of folks come by that have use cases that, while very interesting, just aren't, you know, aren't ideal for Saltbox. And we, our focus really is on enabling those customers that we think we're the best positioned to support.
Now, what in a lot of co-working spaces, they have virtual memberships where they have access to a kind of the illusion of an office that they can come and go as they please because they don't need it on a regular basis. Does Saltbox have an offering like that?
Yeah, that's a great question. We do. It's not quite virtual, but I you know refer to it as a community membership. And one of the things that's unique about that in our case is that you're not just getting access to a hot desk and coffee. You're getting access to our photography studio. You're getting access to, you know, self-service, kind of, you know, fulfillment stations, all of our community events. And so it really is, again, you know, designed for, in this case, that aspiring, you know, early stage seller.
So now what, drove Saltbox to choose Atlanta as the place to open this? Is this the only location right now?
This is, we opened our first location in December, excuse mm-hmm. me. We're opening another three this year.
In the metro area or in other markets?
Still determining, very likely one more here this year and a few others elsewhere. And why Atlanta? Atlanta is my home, and I happen to think it's one of the best places in the country right now to start a company, especially like ours.
Why? Because of the strength in logistics and supply chain?
Not so much. I mean, quite honestly, our business isn't really dependent upon that. I mean, for the most part, you know, our members aren't bringing in, you know, truckloads of pallets every day. I would say really it has more to do with the entrepreneurial community here and just the density of, in particular, of physical goods, merchants and just kind of the strength, you know, behind their growth.
So tell us a little bit about your backstory.
Yeah.
You mentioned a background in high tech. What does that mean exactly?
Yeah, sure. You know, early career in finance in New York, but in 2009, I moved out to Silicon Valley and I joined a company called Palantir, Palantir Technologies, which is a now large data analytics software company. And I ran all of our operations there. So everything from IT to recruiting, real estate, and such. And, you know, we grew a lot during that period from about 70 people to about 2,000 or so. So it was a wild time.
Now, is Saltbox the only kind of co-working space doing what you're doing here, at least in the metro area?
Yes. I would say that if you look across the globe, you know, there's probably on the order of a million or so square feet of space that is similar to ours, none quite like it, but similar. But that's a almost immeasurable amount in relation to what there ought to be.
And then from the member standpoint, how much space are they typically needing at this stage in their business?
Yeah, you know, it ranges. So we have one can come in and get a community membership. And literally a you know 50 kind of a 50 square foot micro suite we call it, or you can get up to 2,000 or 3,000 square feet of space, which you know seems small in the context of traditional warehousing, but is really quite large when you walk in and think about the size of company that one might run out of such a space.
And then who is this e-commerce kind of entrepreneur? Is it just somebody that's got a side hustle and is doing this because they, you know, watch a YouTube video and this seems kind of doable? You know, they've been on Amazon, they can see how this thing works.
Yeah. You know, it is all the above. I think the reality is that 20 years ago, there was virtually no e-commerce in the world. Today, e-commerce represents 12-15% of our total retail sales, right? And that number is going to double again over the next, 10 years or so. And so when we talk about who is the seller, I mean, we're talking about literally trillions of dollars of selling that's happening in a given year. And of course, a material amount of that is derived from very large companies, but a much bigger long tail of it comes from small companies. And so, it can certainly be the person who's, you know, working a side hustle or just getting started, but it can also be, you know, larger, relatively larger companies that are operating lifestyle businesses, or in some cases, even, you know, rapidly growing companies. So it really is a very, very broad range.
And then Salt Barks is aimed towards that long tail, right?
That's right. That's right. The long tail being companies that are $15 million or less today. Mm-hmm. I would say if you were running an e-commerce business or any sort of physical goods business, which requires distribution, and you believe you can operate in less than 5,000 square feet of warehouse space, Salt Barks is probably something you should consider.
Now, is there anything that the entrepreneur maybe is leaving on the table by not pursuing e-commerce? Maybe they have brick and mortar and they don't see themselves as an e-commerce play, but maybe in your experience of doing this for a minute or two that you've said, you know what, there might be an opportunity there if because we have a lot of the infrastructure already built for you.
Yeah. Well, at first I would say that, you know, although I'm highlighting this e-commerce seller, we certainly serve, you know, customers that are not selling online, in some cases they aren't even selling. You know, Salt Barks is well suited for services companies that have physical inventory or equipment to manage. It's excellent for makers and so on and so forth. But to answer your question, absolutely, I think that if you're in a retail business today, you are looking towards the future and thinking about e-commerce, you will certainly find a really resourceful and supportive community at Salt Barks.
So if you're a member, is there education that's going to help me take my business to the next level? Is that a component of Salt Barks, or is it just kind of the stuff?
That is a big component of Salt Barks. We have a very active schedule of educational events as well as community building events. In fact, we have one on Thursday this week. I believe there's a lunch and learn on growth marketing. Mm-hmm. And beyond the structured programming that we're providing, again, I think one of the real joys of Salt Barks is that you begin to learn from your neighbors. You know,
right.
you move from these isolated environments. It really sucks working in a self-storage facility, to, you know,
sure.
working around peers who can help you, understand, you know, their experience and work through whatever challenge you have.
And I think that one of the biggest benefits of a ecosystem like yours is that, the opportunity for kind of a mashup to occur where somebody's situation maybe isn't going as they'd like it to, and they can kind of join forces with somebody else in the community and then kind of bring a complementary skill that might help both of them.
Yeah, I think that's, I could see that happening. We similarly, we've already had, you know, we've seen members coming together in order to distribute products. You know, one company is manufacturing you know, product A, and the other company is selling similar types of products. And so, you know, there's all sorts of, you know, serendipitous interactions that are happening right. there that are valuable.
Yeah, we do the radio for ATDC, and they call those collisions. Like, they try to kind of have the serendipitous collisions occurring by creating yeah. those education and those kind of community building events.
Absolutely.
So what do you need more of right now? You were in Silicon Valley. I'm sure it wasn't for the weather.
it too was not for capital. Yeah, we've been fortunate to have some great investors you know around the table with us. And so what I need more of are great members and more feedback on what's wrong with the product and how we can improve it. So, you know, I would encourage folks to come by and tour the space and tell us all the things that you don't like.
And where are you located?
Upper West Side. So if you guys know where Top Golf is, West Midtown, we're
right
on the
corner. Nuevo Laredo?
Nuevo Laredo.
Yeah, we know right. where the lobster tacos
where that
are.
Is. Yeah.
We don't play golf, but
the
we
giant
eat lobster.
Margaritas. Yeah,
exactly. That's right. I know exactly that. So yeah. that's where the
1345 Seaboard Industrial.
Good stuff. Yeah, well, thank you so much.
Join Saltbox.
Thank you so much for sharing your story today. And the website again is joinsaltbox.com.
That's it.
Well, and keep up the good work, man. We'll continue to follow your story. Hey, stay with us. We're going to visit with a few more guests, okay?
Excellent.
All right. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, we have with us partners and principals with Hatteras Sky, Jason Corden and Amy Kelly. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
So tell us about Hatteras Sky. Both of you kind of at the same time. Do you coordinate this?
In sync.
No, you have a
PR person right there.
Where is the script?
Come on.
I need my piece of paper. Hatter Sky is a real estate development firm, and we specialize in tax incentivized real estate. So what that really means is the government uses the tax code to incentivize certain types of activities. Principally for us, it's affordable housing, historic redevelopment, renewable energy, and something that came out about 2 years ago, opportunity zones. We're here to talk a little bit about those. We've got a pretty diversified team committed to that, and we also raise equity for our own deals. So we're integrated in that fashion in that we're a developer and kind of raise equity.
So now Tyler's business would have been a perfect situation for you, right? Where in terms of that kind of a building, if it was in an area that was an opportunity zone or maybe in an area that's, I don't know, the real estate of that, but that's a situation where if you would have got to Tyler early, you might have been able to help him with some, maybe a better location in terms of tax incentives and credits.
Well, I was actually thinking that as I was listening to him, that there is a very close parallel in terms of locating certain real estate in an opportunity zone, which is just a geographic area that is designated. And if you do that, then the owners of those businesses get certain tax breaks that really help them grow their business.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about his members? Would the members also be eligible for those tax breaks since they're kind of subletting his space or a member of his space?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking.
So now, how do you get in front of somebody like him at the right time in order, like, because that might not have been in when he was looking at locations for his space, he may not have even considered this at all.
Yeah, for us, we have to go around and there's a lot of education because it is a brand new tax incentive that people have heard a little bit about, but they don't really get into the details on it and get very straightforward guidance on how do they take advantage of it.
So now, what led you to this side of the real estate business?
Well, I began my background. My background is I was a tax attorney for 15 years prior to founding
We're both recovering attorneys.
But I spent 15 years in this practice of representing developers and institutional investors in these types of real estate projects. And finally, about 6 years ago, decided to step out and go to the business side.
So now when you're talking to somebody, like what's the kind of, give me a kind of a success story in terms of, hey, I'm thinking of buying a warehouse or an office and I'm picking area A and you're like, hey, if you pick area B, that's in an opportunity zone. Like what kind of is a range of financial win for me to make one choice over another? Is it dramatic or is this kind of an incremental thing?
Well, to be clear, so at Hatteras Sky, we are a real estate development firm. So we actually are building real estate for the benefit of ourselves and our investors. Sometimes people do come to us because Jason and I speak across the country about opportunity zones and we're both lawyers. And so I think they trust our insights on the program. And so they will ask us, you know, where should we locate and things like that. But we're not an advisory firm. So we're not helping them necessarily pick a location, but I guess just coincidentally or incidentally, we are asked sometimes for advice on that. And so we do get calls a lot, especially in Georgia, about, you know, where people could locate. And so we try to put people together so that maybe somebody like Tyler could team up with a developer who has an empty building in an opportunity zone, which we know about because of our real estate development.
So
business.
You're primarily going out, you're building your own things, and then you're leasing your own things. And then the people who lease there can benefit from the fact that you leased in an opportunity zone.
That's
right. And you were asking a little bit about the benefit, and I'll kind of give the 20-second story. The investment is designed to basically, it's a 10-year investment if you're going to invest in an opportunity zone, either as a business owner or an investor. And what it really does is basically all the gain you have in the business if you hold it for 10 years, if it's real estate or an operating business, when you sell, you don't have to pay tax on your gain in that business. So the benefit is really depending on how successful the business is. So a lot of what the opportunity zone background is from Silicon Valley with a lot of the venture capital funds out there recognizing they may invest $5 million in a company and in 10 years it's worth $1 billion. Well, if you exit that company, You're not paying any tax on what is essentially a $1 billion gain. And that would be the idea. Now, how we use that is we use it more in a real estate context where we actually develop in an opportunity zone. The building appreciates in value. We hold it 10 years. We sell. Our investors don't pay tax on the gain. What we found is that it takes what is a lower kind of market accepted return in the low teens for an investor. And with the tax benefits, it adds 4 or 5 IRR points over that 10 year period to get it looking more favorably and encouraging investment in these lower income areas.
And then what type of development are you doing? Is it the kind of residential? Is it the office, warehouse?
So it's all kinds of commercial real estate, but primarily multifamily and hospitality. We're doing some industrial, and we're doing it across the country. So we're based here in Atlanta. We've got 14 people here, but we are developing multifamily in Seattle, in Phoenix, you know, very high growth markets. We're doing hospitality in Salt Lake City also. And then we've got a large portfolio in Asheville, North Carolina, which, although not a major market, is a high growth market.
And then are these the combination of kind of where you live? There's retail and so those kind of multi live, work, play kind of places?
Yeah, we're doing a lot of mixed use. One of the kind of company philosophies is to take innovation you see in other industries where if you look at, you know, just the advancement of automobiles over the last 20 years, the advancement of cell phones, technology. When you look at real estate, you don't actually usually view it as a developer that same way. So what we want to do is when in every one of our projects, we want to kind of take it to the next level in terms of what is different, what can we be taking from innovation in other industries and putting it in the real estate. So for us, we really focus, as Amy was saying, on multifamily hospitality. It's where people, you know, stay, they vacation, and we try to make that a better experience, a place where we would want to be. And that's kind of the philosophy of how we look at it.
So is there kind of somebody that's the gold standard of that right now that you're like, yeah, we want to do things that look like this?
Hatteras Sky.
So what's it? Do you have a development that's up and running somewhere?
We have one that we really are proud of in up in Asheville. It's an industrial building where we've taken there's a lot of artists in Asheville, and we've let them come in, and they're going to be doing their thing with it, which means, you know, they make it cool. We'll turn it over to them. And then we rent it out to subtenants who are looking for that kind of alternative office space. We're taking a parking lot with it, and we're going to rip it up and then turn it into like a community garden. So that one's in an opportunity zone, and it allows us to kind of do what is maybe not the highest and best use for that property, but to turn it into something that's kind of a statement that is very accepted by the locals in that neighborhood. So I think those are the types of things opportunity zones are letting us do that we wouldn't otherwise do, but with that benefit, it makes it viable economically.
But you're kind of the curator of what's happening in that space. You're deciding ahead of time, okay, this is the kind of space it is. And then now we're just going to fill it with tenants that kind of meet that,
that's right,
profile.
Yep.
Now, are you seeing what we're seeing here in Atlanta, at least we're seeing here in the studio, of all these niche co-working spaces open that are just serving specific groups, like Tyler's serving kind of warehouse e-commerce. We've had on people that are serving, you know, just wellness people. There's gaming co-working spaces. Now there's all these kind of niche ones where at one point it was just kind of a free for all.
Yeah. And I think that goes to the earlier comment I made, is that we're trying to be a little bit forward thinking with respect to what tenants want, and recognizing that, you know, for us, we probably don't want to go and build something and put a Best Buy in it or something
right,
like that on a 15 or 20 year lease, because we don't really believe that's where the market will be. And there's a lot more, I think, in this generation, entrepreneurs who want what Tyler's providing. And so that's kind of how we focus. We've got a very large project on the west side of town near you, and it's a 100,000 square foot restaurant or industrial building. And we're looking at kind of blending in restaurant, retail, office, multifamily housing, pretty much everything within it, to create a sense of community there that's embodying kind of the vibe of the West Side without changing it, but making it fresh.
Now, are you seeing more of those? Because I'm seeing more of these food hall kind of concepts. Is that part of this or?
No. So, It depends.
It's a secret.
It's not a secret.
It's an inside joke almost.
Yeah. So the west side, I mean, the land prices are pretty high. And right. so, you know, what we understand from our analysis is that it's hard to make money on a food haul. And, you know, when you have a relatively high basis.
Right.
So it may not be a great area for food haul. I think
in that location.
Yeah. You can make a food haul work if you want to maybe have a loss leader for a few years while a community is developing, but, or if you have a low basis in land, but if you're paying a lot for the land, it's really hard to just to make money, in the short term.
So that is that part of why you're kind of having diverse clients so that you're kind of hedging some of these bets. So you're not trying to pick a winner necessarily.
I don't really view it that way. I think we're trying to, again, be out in front of where do people want to go. So we have a hotel.
But that's like an educated guess. You're trying to be out in front of something that may or may not exist in 10 years.
So I think it goes with the view of like we're trying to do what we think works within our own organization. We've got a pretty diverse team. We sit down and say, how do we program something that when people leave it, they want to come back to it? Mm-hmm. And one of the projects we have in Asheville we're working on is a hotel that is, you know, other people view it as a hotel. We view it more or less as an entertainment site because we're going to have an event space that colleges can use, a music venue, festivals, restaurant, bar, F&B. We'll have a record kind of bar in there. And the hotel is really nothing more than there's an elevator over there. Where does that go to? It happens to go to hotel rooms, which is a little bit of a different vibe on how a hotel is normally thought of. It's not the feature of what we're doing, even though we're spending the most money on that part. We're downplaying the significance of the hotel and saying, this is where you want to be.
Right. So that's just an element in the overall experience.
That's right.
So now, take me through the beginnings of Hatteras Sky. What was the first project and what was the impetus of saying, okay, we're going to play in this space?
Yeah, well, Amy and I was a principal and Amy was an executive at a prior company that we had, founded, and the development arm that we built out of Atlanta, we spun out into Hatteras Sky. The other company grew very large and, our focus wanted to be on development. So we spun out Hatteras Sky. Our first projects are, really what we're doing in Asheville and some of the other projects Amy, just mentioned across the country.
So then you had this idea, you said, okay, we're going to be in Asheville. And then you had to kind of round up the investors, or this was all self-funded by you and your team?
So the way our business really grew is because of the tax incentives of what we were doing in some of our prior companies with like historic rehabilitation, and Asheville is a great historic town. We'd bought a lot of assets there that were historic. We've preserved those and we're turning them now into, you know, new adaptive reuses. We had a lot of those around the country. We really focused on Asheville because we really liked the market. The other projects that we have were really purposefully acquired and are being developed as opportunity zone projects, whereas some of the stuff we just came from a prior business and they made sense for us to do.
So now, are there opportunity zones in every market, or is this kind of something that's like what is a profile of an opportunity zone?
Sure.
Is it like kind of in the areas that aren't developed at all? Are they in bad neighborhoods where it's dangerous? Is it in historic, or is it a mix?
So generally speaking, it's a mix. But the background to how do you know where an opportunity zone is, first of all, you can Google opportunity zone map.
So it's all public.
It's out there. Each state has them. The governor of each state was able to take certain qualified census tracts that had the income levels associated with them as being a lower income neighborhood area, and was able to select 25% of all of those areas in their state and designate them as opportunity zones. So this is pretty unique for the federal government to let the states really decide where they want their investment dollars to go and how. And all of this was based off of 2010 census information. So each governor was able to work on a process, and they each took a different process to it. So like in Atlanta, we're very familiar, the west side of town, the new West Side Park they're building, there's a lot of opportunity zones surrounding that park, which a lot of people would say, well, why does an area like that need an to be designated as an opportunity zone. And I think for us, it's important because there's a very big push in Atlanta to get more affordable housing inside the perimeter, especially on the west side. So by designating as an opportunity zone, it does get you cheaper capital that will allow you to designate units as workforce housing or affordable. And I think that's really in line with the city's mission right now.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note, though, that not all opportunity zones are in urban areas. There are a lot of rural opportunity zones as well. And I think in Georgia, they tried to have some kind of mix between rural and urban, you know, just not to focus on the big cities, but also include some of the counties and rural areas as well.
Now, you mentioned the census as kind of being a driver for this round of it. So the 2020, there'll be another census. Is that going to change things?
It doesn't affect the census tracts that have already been designated.
So once it's designated, it's an opportunity zone. So in 2020, if they change it and say, okay, now that's these are the opportunity zones, the other ones don't go away. They're just now there's new opportunity zones.
Correct. I think the rule is, and Jason, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that once it's designated an opportunity zone, it is one for 10 years.
Yeah, that's right. And with respect to what's going on with the future of the program, I think the government's taking a little bit of a wait and see approach before they expand the program. So it was a program that was enacted with a sunset in it, meaning it goes away automatically unless it's reenacted. And one of the things that the government did on this and it was they wanted to let more of the private individuals, the people in those neighborhoods, dictate how this works. So there's not a lot of, and I say this, and I don't want to say it in a bad way, but there's not as much government oversight on this program as there has been on other tax legislation. Mm-hmm. And I think that's intentional because they want to see, will it work if we design a system this way, or will people abuse it and not kind of do deals that are in line with the spirit of the purpose of the statute? And so I think over the next 2 years, we'll know a lot more about it. One of the things is in the State of the Union address last week, President Trump specifically mentioned the success of the program thus far. So it's on firms like ours to take these tax benefits and incorporate them into deals that also serve the social agenda.
And then so you're seeing that happening? Because like what was the Beltline? Was that taking advantage of opportunity zones here, or that wasn't relevant for the development of the Beltline?
The Beltline on the East Side Trail was all done pre-opportunity zones. So that had nothing to do with this program. But it does bring up a really good point is that there are opportunity zones in the country that you'd be surprised by when you're saying, well, are they in all bad neighborhoods? Are they in lower income areas? Not all opportunity zones are created equal. So, for instance, we had a project and we sold the land in Hollywood, California, building a hotel overlooking the Hollywood sign. Now, I would say when you're there, the area is pretty developed, but you can certainly understand why there's a need for additional development in that area and a tax incentive to encourage it. But I wouldn't normally think of that as the first place in the country that needs, you know, additional designation for investment.
Right. Yeah, the design district in Miami is also in an opportunity zone, and that's where
in Wynwood?
Yes, but so the Hermes store and the Rolex store, all of that is in an opportunity zone, but it's just because of the way the census tract is shaped. It just happens to include that area. So,
and then what do you say to the people that, you know, are kind of clamoring for more affordable housing? Is there a way to make affordable housing kind of work in this?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something, given that we're doing a lot of multifamily, every one of our projects has a set aside for workforce housing in it. There are other government incentives that exist. So there's an affordable housing tax credit, where if you build a true affordable housing development, then there's something that is not related to opportunity zones at all. And one of the things we're doing and looking at is combining opportunity zone development with affordable housing in one development to take advantage of both programs. Mm-hmm. And what that does is it encourages, in our opinion, a little bit more diversified affordable housing. So it may be that you have true affordable housing and then you have like a workforce housing component, which have different standards under the law as to what qualifies as a tenant for those. And we think that's a good thing.
So now for Hatteras Sky, when you go into community, it sounds like you have a pretty compelling story to tell the folks there, including the government folks as well as the people there. Congratulations on all your success. What do you need more of right now? It sounds like you got everything's going your way.
Yeah, we're very busy, and the projects we currently have are pretty much slated for our development pipeline with investors in it. But what we need is for people to understand a lot more about what opportunity zones are. And
so more education and
more education.
So who do you want to be educating?
For us, it's about finding capital. You know, we know where the deals are. We know what we want to do. And, we usually reach out and we will, you know, CPAs, RIAs, family offices, other high net worth individuals. The program is designed for people who have had a capital gain event.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyone who's selling a business and is looking to invest, a small portion of their portfolio could be allocated towards an opportunity zone investment that is getting them a compelling economic return. And in addition to that, is going to have some sort of social impact, you know, associated with it that they might not get just with an advisor who's purely looking only at the economics of every deal. And, you know, ourselves included, we invest in other opportunity zone deals just for that reason. It actually feels good. Again, it's people who are selling businesses, people who have large stock portfolios who are looking to liquidate at the high point of the market or what people believe is the high point of the market, but they don't want to pay the tax to do that. You can sell and roll over that investment into an opportunity zone investment.
And if somebody wanted to learn more, what's the website coordinates?
It's hatterassky.com, HatterasSky.com.
Fantastic. Hey, stay with us. We've got one more guest we're going to visit with this morning. All right, Lee, you ready for the headliner?
I am.
She's been very patient over there. She's been nodding her head. She's been taking notes. She's been smiling. We have with us the founder and CEO of the Honeypot Company, Miss Beatrice Dixon. Good morning.
Good morning.
You got a rock star of that microphone. Lean in there.
I'm here. Is that good?
That's perfect.
Okay, good. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, tell us about the Honeypot Company.
The Honeypot is a plant-based feminine hygiene company. We focus on, basically wellness around the vagina. I said it on the radio.
There you go. It's not the first time it's been said today.
I love it. But we really focus on products that are really great for daily, monthly. You know, we're not the average feminine hygiene company where we only focus kind of on one area. We do washes, wipes, pads, tampons. You know, lubricants, we do all kinds of things. So, and the great thing is we're sold in mass market retail. We're also sold online. We're sold on Amazon. So you can pretty much throw a stone and find us.
So now, tell us about the origin of this business.
Well, you know, a lot of times the mother of necessity, the mother of invention is necessity. And for me, that was the case. I had an infection that I couldn't get rid of. And one night I went to sleep and I had a dream with one of my ancestors and we were sitting at a table talking and she handed me a piece of paper and she told me that this would get rid of my problem. And so, you know, she said, when you wake up, I'm going to make sure you remember. So when you wake up, write it down. As soon as you wake up, I woke up, wrote it down, made it. If it was Monday, by Friday, everything was gone. And so, you know, and it stayed away. You know, which was beautiful, which I hadn't experienced in almost a year. And so I felt like, you know, I had been gifted my life's work. And then on top of that, I felt like I would be able to help other women that were dealing with the same situation that I was dealing with. And for 2 years, we did our own version of a clinical trial. I asked as many women to try it as possible. 90% of those women were seeing the same results. The time came for us to launch it. We launched it at the Bronner Brothers Hair Show. We sold 600 bottles in a weekend and the rest is kind of history, you know?
And tell us about the history because it is a big deal, your rapid growth and
yeah.
Who you're working with and affiliated with.
Yeah, we've you know, it's funny because it doesn't feel rapid. But it is rapid, you know, like it, when you think about it, you know, it takes about 10 years to build a really good business. Right.
Right.
And we've been doing this since 2012. And so, you know, but since 2014 is really when we started to see a lot of growth happen. You know, we got into Whole Foods Market. We got into Seven Nanda, which was like our very first retailer, actually, which is a co-op in Little Five Points. We launched online. We launched on Amazon. From there, we were really fortunate because Target came to us. The buyer had heard about us from her hairdresser. Crazy. And, you know, we still had to go through all the challenges that every other brand has to go through when getting into retail. But we were fortunate that they came to us and that we attracted them. And we got into Target, you know, we got four of our items into Target. 6 months later, we got four more in, you know, a year later from that, we got into Walmart, we got into Walgreens, we got into CVS. It's, you know, it's just been crazy. So actually a couple years later than that. So, you know, it's been a really beautiful journey. You know, we've been fortunate to be able to raise money and,
About that a little bit because that's a big deal too.
Yeah, that's hard. Which I'm sure you guys know. Mm-hmm. Raising capital is rough, especially, but I can say, I don't know if I was the 38th or 39th Black woman to raise over $1 million, but I'm somewhere in that arena. Mm-hmm. And when you think about how sad that is, right? Then when you think about venture capital,
good for you.
It's great for me, but it's relative, right? Because when you look at my counterparts, they've probably raised my competitors in the natural arena. They've raised like $100 million when you put three companies together almost. Mm-hmm. I've raised four. So when you compare it, it's a beautiful thing. I'm fortunate to have raised the money that we've raised. Don't make me wrong. But when you look at the fact that like 0.2% of venture capital goes to Black women startups or, you know, Black women founders, it's a little touch and go. You know, but what that's forced us to do is be intelligent about our business. It's enforced us to, you know, it's forced us to be lean with our business. It's forced us to build a real business. We're not the business that's raised zillions of dollars. And I'm actually happy that we didn't do that because it's made us more intelligent. It's made us leaner. It's made us more efficient. We've been able to grow in volume retail. And we have a really great product line. So that really works for us. You know, but it's been a beautiful journey.
So now how did you go from having this dream, a literal dream?
Yeah. Right? A literal dream. Yeah.
And then to, I'm going to build a product. I'm going to create it. I'm going to test it. I'm going to get a team together. I'm going to go out and raise $1 million. So I know, it's hard to raise $1 million. For people of color.
It's hard to raise $1 million for anybody.
Exactly.
It's hard for old white guys too. Yeah. I was gonna say.
It is, but it's but it's a lot harder. Yeah.
Right.
It's a lot harder. Right. Yeah.
It's all on the spectrum of hard.
Absolutely. So. It's relative.
So for you to have achieved this kind of success is phenomenal.
Thank you.
And you should be proud of it. But how, for some lessons for the young entrepreneurs out there, how did you build a team that gave confidence to somebody to say, here's $1 million?
Well, our first round of capital was a family and friends round. We raised, it's when we got into Target. We raised like $750,000. That was from a collective.
I don't have that kind of friend.
You got better friends than me.
It's just an expression for rounds of funding. But it's funny. my brother and co-founder, Simon Gray, he's an accountant, or he used to have his own practice. So we were fortunate. I was fortunate to have him because what do accountants know? People with money, right? And so that gave us access to people. You know, that year was really rough because that 750 didn't really go far. Mm-hmm. When you go into retail, especially a mass market retailer, what they don't tell you is that, the retailer doesn't pay you before you have to order your products, right? So you have to, and not only that, when you're ordering at this level, you're not at the place where you're just going and ordering a couple thousand units. You're ordering like 50,000 units because when you think about the retail game, it's all margins and the margins are like paper thin. It's kind of like the restaurant business, right? it's crazy. But
so in your dream, your ancestor didn't mention this part.
She didn't mention this part. But from there, we made a lot of mistakes. We had a lot of out of stocks. if I was talking to a young investor, I would tell them, or excuse me, a young person that wants to get into the consumer packaged goods business, I would tell them, don't go into retail right away. Make a hundred thousand online first. Yeah. And make $100,000 a benchmark, right? Because you can take that $100,000 and you can spend that when you're going to talk to a retailer. You can also spend that when you're going to go talk to an investor. Because if an investor knows that you've put your skin in the game and you figured out how to make $100,000,
right?
Then they're going to feel a lot more comfortable giving you whatever the amount of money is that you're asking for to grow your company.
So now, for you at this stage, now you're in all the major places, right?
Pretty much. Yeah.
More to go?
I mean, we have at least a foot in the door at pretty much every major retailer that you can think of.
And that's in the U.S. or is it international now?
It's only in the U.S. And we've done that intentionally. We likely won't go international until 2021 because U.S. is a feat all by itself. Right. And, you know, we're a company that hopefully one day is going to go through an acquisition and sell. So, you know, it's in our best interest to really focus on
and kind of lock down.
Lock this down. It'll be great if we can go into a Mexico or we can go into London or something like that, but it has to be really strategic and it can't be too complicated.
And again, you mentioned kind of you want to be acquired at some point. When your goal is to be acquired, do you do things strategically a little different than if your goal was to, you know,
absolutely,
kind of take over the world?
Absolutely. Any business, you have to have a North Star. Right. You have to begin with the end in mind. But, in my business, there's definitely a roadmap. You know, you want to make sure that you have an eye towards some sort of profitability. You want to make sure that you have an eye towards having a good EBITDA. Right. You want to make sure.
Sounds like your brother's been talking.
Yeah.
I don't know. Ancestor mentioned EBITDA in that dream.
No, but I mean, this is my business to know these things, right? I mean, I'm the CEO of a company and I have to understand what it is to run the company. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, but you have to have your eye on that. There's definitely a back door and there's definitely a roadmap to understanding how you get to those places.
So now what's been the most rewarding part of this adventure?
The most rewarding part is that I'm fortunate enough to make products for humans with vaginas, that improve their lives. I don't take that lightly. I don't take it lightly that we've had the success that we've had. I'm fortunate to have the partners that I do. I'm fortunate to be able to do cool things with my friends. You know, I live really well. And I don't live well because I have millions of dollars in the bank or anything like that. But I live well because I get to do what I want to do. And that is a true form of financial freedom. When you can live how you choose to live and make your money how you choose to make it, you know, and so for me, that's the most gratifying thing.
Now, when you started the company and, you know, you're just launching it, what was your background that you were able to kind of pull this all off? Because this is, you know, you're walking a tightrope. You had a lot of things had to go your way and you were able to pull it off successfully.
Right. I had a lot of experience. I wanted to be a doctor. I wanted to be an anesthesiologist, but then I realized, because I worked in the healthcare industry for 10 years, I was a pharmacy technician, but I wasn't just the pharmacy tech that you go to Walgreens and see. I've been in oncology. I've been in hospitals. I've worked in chemo. I've worked in, I've batched, skincare, you know, I've done all the things.
So healthcare, you were familiar with a lot of the kind of behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Stuff.
Yeah. Cause when you work in a hospital, and there's an IV that goes up to the floor. It's not the pharmacist that makes that. It's the tech that makes that. Mm-hmm. So that gave me the understanding of technically how to mix something and how to do the math on what you need to do to mix it. Then I left from there and I went to work for Whole Foods because I got tired of being in a toxic work environment. Not that hospitals are necessary, but it doesn't always, it's based around medicine. It's not necessarily based around, I don't know how to say that without it sounding crazy, but, You know, so I left there. I went to work for Whole Foods. I worked for Whole Foods for 3 years. I was a merchandiser and a buyer. I left there and I went to be a food broker. That's where I represented over 100 brands. So then my customer didn't become the person that went to shop at the store. My customer became the store.
Right.
Then I left from there and I went to be an area sales manager for a kale chip company, which was a startup. So I know how to go and talk to a buyer.
Right. But all those experiences, when you look back, it seems like logical that you would do what you're doing and have the skills to pull it off.
Absolutely.
Because each one of those things by themselves maybe didn't make sense to be by himself.
But when you put it all together,
they all helped you get to where you are.
Absolutely. It did.
So congratulations on all your success. That's a big deal.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
You should be very proud. I mean, that's a big achievement.
Yeah, it is an achievement. And I'm happy to be here.
Keep going and you're moving, but you got to sometimes just appreciate where you've been and how far you've come.
I have loads of gratitude for where I am. Mm-hmm. I don't have an ego about it though. But I'm happy to be here and I don't take it lightly. And I appreciate all that's been afforded to me. Exactly. Yeah. Success is relative, right?
Got to keep moving forward.
Exactly.
So now if somebody wanted to learn more about The Honey Pot, where should they go?
They can find us at thehoneypot.co. You can go into any Target. We're in 2,000 Walmart doors. We're also in Walgreens. We're in CVS, but only in a couple places. So if you want to find us in store, you can go to thehoneypot.co and go to the store locator, put in your zip code, and it'll tell you where to find us.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you so much for having me here.
All right. This is a wrap for Atlanta Business Radio, number one at the Sandy Springs Innovation Center. This is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.